This is an ABC podcast.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
How do you process witnessing and experiencing something like the horror at Bondi on Saturday afternoon when your daily life is thrown into chaos and fear in an instant? This is a witness, Johan, who spoke with Hamish McDonald on the project.
My mouth will say one thing, but my body will probably say something else. I certainly kept saying I was fine the whole time, and not being able to sleep is evidence that that's not the case. I got up this morning, I had a coffee, I got dressed to come here, and I walked on the beach. So those are wins. But that's all I did, really. I didn't quite sleep till 4 o'clock. Again, I don't feel particularly, you know, that I'm specifically traumatized. I don't know what that feels like, or I don't know what I'm supposed to feel, but it's definitely quite uneasy, and there's a certain like tenseness to everything I'm doing. It's quite palpable, and it's quite just eerie in that sense. Yeah,
I'm not sure what I'm supposed to feel. And after you've witnessed something like that, we saw incredible scenes. There's one that will stay with me, and that was the image of a father who placed face masks over his daughter's eyes, two daughters either side. He had them clutched under either arm, and he put face masks over their eyes and held them tight so that they couldn't witness and couldn't see what was happening in the shopping centre. We saw strangers step up and try and save people's lives, but then we saw the shock and trauma on their faces as they tried to retell what they went through to the waiting media. We saw shop attendants turn into first responders to ensure that customers were safe. So what happens to our body and brain afterwards? How do we then process that trauma? How do we store that trauma in our brains and in our bodies? Good morning. My name's Rochelle Hunt, your co-host this morning, Daniel Miles, joining you from ABC Warrnambool. Daniel, the impacts are so far-reaching. Hundreds, if not thousands, of people have been affected in some way by what happened on Saturday afternoon, whether it be witnessing or experiencing it at Bondi, doom scrolling on social media, or having some kind of trigger response because you've been through something yourself, maybe Bourke Street or some other event. It's so widespread, isn't it? And how do you know if you're traumatized?
That's the thing. How do you know if you've experienced trauma when that's something completely new to you? As you mentioned, you don't have to live anywhere near Bondi or even know anyone remotely involved to experience, I guess, a sense of grief over what's happened. I mean, I know I spent a large portion of the weekend just feeling numb, having read and seen some of those visuals that you mentioned, a father just trying to protect his daughter. That's something so visceral and tangible that it's hard to keep out of your mind in many ways. This was the deadliest act of mass violence we've seen in Australia in decades. Six people just went shopping and they never came home. And I think there's something so real about that, but also the bloody violence that really was attached to it. And I guess the one thing, or one of the things at least, that we've learned from this and every other tragedy globally that's come before it, is there's a concept of early intervention and psychological first aid, which is something that we're going to try and delve a little bit into throughout the show today. This is a really new and unique approach to provide support and coping strategies to help people manage in the immediate aftermath of what they've just experienced. But like we heard in that grab, how do you know that you've experienced trauma when you haven't before? There are so many signs that are probably missed, I reckon.
Absolutely. And as a society, as loved ones, as professionals, as first responders, as parents, as carers, as teachers, how do we know what to look out for? How do we know what to do and what to say? There is a body of growing research, of emerging research, that shows us now, because unfortunately events and traumatic events like this happen and will continue to happen. So not only what can we learn from it, but what is the research that shows how we can best protect ourselves, how we can recognise trauma, post-traumatic stress disorder, and how we can best deal with that, and how can we move forward? What works? What helps? What is the research telling us, whether it be recognising PTSD, the right language and the right techniques to use to support someone not only in the days, but maybe the years after experiencing a traumatic event.
When I heard the news on Saturday, Raf, it brought back all the misery of what occurred in Melbourne in Bourke Street.
Yeah.
And it was very mindful to me of that. The same fear and the same sense of unknowing and waiting for all those hours to have a result. And I'm very mindful of what occurred to those people in Bourke Street. And I think of them every time I go into Melbourne. I think you ever forget that. Yes, I think of it. And that dreadful day and the horrible misery that so many people suffered. I think that might be happening to those in Bondi too.
That's a caller to Raphael Ebstein's morning program this morning. Good morning, Rochelle Hunt and Daniel Miles with you. As we look at what helps from understanding what triggers there are, understanding what post-traumatic stress disorder looks like, and even understanding what trauma looks like and how it manifests in our bodies and what the right thing is to do, because everyone goes through this individually, Daniel.
Yeah, it's not like a scraped knee. You don't see the physical signs in a cut or a bruise or a bump or a scrape. These are some things that people hold in or show in different ways. And it's not just about this one incident that's happened. As that caller so brilliantly put it, this can be a trauma that's happened 10, 20 years ago. It can be Bourke Street. It could be 9/11. It could be any of the numerous horrific tragedies that we've been through as a society, that something like this, something that was so far away, so unexpected in many ways, can bring up those signs. And it's really about looking after each other. But also, as you mentioned, finding out what those signs are and from the research that's been done, know how to actually approach it.
And what helps and what doesn't? There's a text here from Enya that says, you know, what have we learned, in particular, say, from the Twin Towers? We have to stop showing the footage, tell people to stop watching. This is trauma-inducing. And another saying, re-trauma, look out for the nightmares and the unsettled sleep. And we heard that from the witness that spoke to Hamish McDonald on the project. They said, I think I feel fine. That being said, I haven't slept. There's another text here that said, a friend and I witnessed a car crash. My reaction was to help and to do first aid. Hers was to freeze. She's feeling the PTSD a lot more. Apparently, freeze reactions are worse for PTSD than that fight or flee. Mine is to fight. Well, Michael Burge knows a lot about this. He's an OAM. He's also the director of the Australian College of Trauma Treatment. Michael, a warm welcome to the Conversation Hour.
Thank you.
You and I professionally have been talking about PTSD and trauma, I reckon, on and off for about 20
That's
years.
Right. That's right, about 20 years. Time flies.
Time does fly. How far have we come in understanding and recognising what trauma looks like in our bodies and brains? As we just heard right at the beginning of the show, this young man, a witness to what happened to Bondi, said, I don't think I feel traumatised, however, I haven't slept.
Yeah. Look, I think we have come a long way. I just think about when I first became involved within the area of PTSD under the umbrella of Veterans Affairs with Vietnam veterans and other veterans, well over 30 years ago. We have come a long way in terms of community understanding, and I think media programs, newspapers, programs like this have been fantastic in making the public aware about what PTSD, what trauma is. But as you mentioned, you can't be too prescriptive on an individual level. Different people react differently. So on the one hand, there are some very common, almost universal human-type reactions, which is great. We also need to be mindful not to be too prescriptive and place expectations on how people will cope with that.
The right and wrong way to respond.
That's right, yep. That's right.
Michael, what does trauma look like in people who haven't been, closely impacted by this or directly linked? People have just seen it on TV, seen it in the news, read about this, feeling that there's something not quite right. I know it's different for everyone, but broadly speaking, how does trauma like this raise its head in those who aren't directly involved?
Sure. Now, particularly with this type of scenario where it's a day-to-day situation, a shopping centre, I would say that probably most people that have an element of humanity, but they will be concerned and feeling grief about what happened. So I would expect people to have their safety generally threatened by this. They'll be thinking about, well, could this happen at their shopping centre? So I would expect to see some kind of stress reaction, some kind of anxiety, some kind of sleep disturbance, some kind of change in a normal type of emotional behaviour or relating. So, and of course, there's so much trauma. The people, I mean, 70% of the population, the research shows, have experienced trauma in their lives. 70%. So, therefore, there's a strong chance that events like this, especially in normal scenarios, that there could be lots of triggers. So people may then start to have, you know, bad sleep, nightmares, depressive episodes, panic, et cetera, more conflict with the family. So you really have to watch out for those.
Mm. How familiar are the surroundings? Well, let's look at Bondi and the fact that it was a shopping centre. My daughter, for example, turned to me and said, "Mum, that just looks like Southland."
Yes.
She loves Southland, yeah. By the way. Loves Maya, unfortunately, too. We spend a lot of time there, as most families do. That's what a lot of families do. They just hang out at shopping centres. Not even just families, individuals. Even if you're not shopping as such, it's a hangout place. It's a safe space. Yes. It's somewhere where you are. Does how familiar a surrounding and that connection that I think everybody felt to, that could have been me.
Yes.
How do you then recognise the trigger, say, in my daughter, who... like, for example, she's wanted to sleep with me the last couple of nights. So I kind of went, okay, I think I know why that is. Sure. And to be honest, I was kind of happy to have her in and snuggle right next to me.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, you will find, you know, that children tend to be more clingy and tend to be more anxious and want to be comforted more if they have been affected by things like that. You also find that you might say, well, let's go shopping at Myers. You spend a lot of time in Myers shopping.
So should you go there?
What's that?
Should I take her there? I mean, I'm spaying my daughter, but I'm sort of talking on behalf of everybody's kid here. Like, well, how do you know when the right time is to go back?
It's a double-edged sword, if I can use that metaphor. If some children have some reactions, everyone's different. There's genetic type of makeup, personality-wise. Kids have nasty experiences at school. If they are reluctant to go, I wouldn't be pushing them to go straight away. I'd be trying to gradually wind into it and listen and talk to them about what's going on in their individual experience. I'd be emphasising, though, just how rare that event is. Mm. The shopping centres are generally very, very safe places to go to, and trying to actually highlight that as much as possible. So attend to the feelings, attend to signs that there's been some upsetness, and be ready to talk things through in their language at their particular developmental level.
Yeah. Hey, Michael, what role does the media play in this as far as replaying footage? There's obviously some really horrific scenes that went through. There's CCTV that captures it.
Yeah.
What role does the media play in potentially, I guess, a rebroadcasting? Like, we had a text from Ina earlier saying, have we learned nothing from the Twin Towers? Stop showing the footage.
Yeah, well, I think that it's pretty hard to be, once again, to be prescriptive in that way in terms of the expectations of the media. The media is fantastic in terms of alerting the public about what to watch out for, like what we're having this conversation about today, the conversation hour. So that is of terrific benefit, and I've discussed with my clients over the decades just how helpful media programs can be. The Black Saturday bushfires, which I was involved with, veterans, etc. But at the same time, though, people can also be obsessed by trauma when they've been through it and tune in too much. But what really, really helps is a warning before disturbing footage, and people have the opportunity then to perhaps distance themselves from that emotionally, or in fact, switch off.
I guess that's something you would have seen change dramatically in your work when it comes to PTSD, triggers and trauma, is the rise of social media and the sort of footage that we see either online or on television now, and learning how to protect ourselves and others around what we can and can't see.
Yes, true. I mean, social media, et cetera, the internet compared to, say, 30 or 40 years ago, has a dramatic influence that way. So it's very important for people to be educated. Psychoeducation has amazing benefits, whether it's therapeutic or whether it's a type of inoculation to help people prepare for what they might encounter. So it's very important for people to understand what they might be experiencing, and therefore try and mitigate their exposure to social media or other types of media.
And I guess with that in mind, Michael Birch, what about trauma avoidance? We go through so many of these horrific scenarios that are unfolding globally continuously. I understand there's a certain urge to just put your head in the sand or not take it in or just avoid it for your own safety. Is that another, I guess, endorsed method?
Well, the research shows there's various avenues and pathways to thinking about that. On the one hand, when you've actually just been through a trauma, bushfires, a terrorist-type attack, the events like what just happened in Sydney, it's important to buffer yourself from those events. Talk through things with the family, a bit like you mentioned before, psychological first aid, a bit different from critical instant stress debriefing from years ago. Turn to your religious ministers and church for help. Make sure you feel comforted in the best way possible. So that could be defined as avoidance, but I say that as good avoidance. What's less helpful avoidance is when people develop, perhaps, and that's more the fact down the road, 1 month later, perhaps, where they develop post-traumatic stress-type symptoms, in which case they often need help to work through that. And avoidance can be counterproductive, but at the same time needs to be worked through very, very carefully, because if there's too much exposure, they can be sort of aggravating, make things worse. So it's a balancing act, really.
It's incredible just the ongoing work and research that's looking into not only post-traumatic stress disorder, but also just that psychological first aid, which we'll go into with the Red Cross in just a moment. But understanding, reaching out for help and talking about it. We'll give all of the numbers that people can reach out to as well. Just finally, Michael, is the research moving at a rate that you're happy with? Like, are we really as a society talking about it and responding in a way that you would hope?
Well, I think there's been great progress, especially in the last few years, in terms of the traumatic stress area. It's a lot more inclusive type of approaches. We're looking more towards the community to be involved. We're more open to type of therapeutic approaches, art therapy, drama therapy, not just CBT and EMDR, cognitive behavioural therapy, but highlighting the value of us working together as a community, people helping people. That's coming up very strongly.
Thanks so much for your time and your work.
Pleasure.
Michael Burge there, OAM and Director at the Australian College of Trauma Treatment. Many texts on this. My sister was in the Queen Street building. A man went berserk with a rifle. I was traumatised for a long time after. On one hand, I was so grateful that she was unharmed. On the other, I was grief-stricken for the families of those who were harmed. That's from David. Another saying, I was in the State Library on the day of the Russell Street bombing. We got evacuated. I was a uni student. There was a loss of innocent life on that day. This is something that I'll remember from me and in from Melbourne. And others talking about watching things like 9/11 and how that unfolded and not knowing when it would stop gave me PTSD. The horror combined with knowing that there was absolutely nothing we could do about something that was happening in another country. Robin's in Heidelberg West. Morning, Robin.
Oh, hi. I think you just read out my text.
Oh, so you're the one that was watching 9/11. What happened? Tell us about how that reacted to you.
Well, we were on holiday in Hamilton Island. Anyway, we're just there with my family watching TV. And it just came on the TV. And so, you know, we were glued to it, like, what on earth is going on? But it was just horrifying. But I think I felt so helpless, and I was just really upset and then very shaken. But I think it was the whole alarm that happened with the media, like, over and over, replaying of it all over and over again, but also alarms on the radio every time there was an alert. It was just compounded it, and I really did end up with PTSD, even though, and I saw a psychologist. I didn't get flashbacks, but I had every other PTSD type symptom. And it took me years to be even in the same room as when they mentioned 9/11.
Yeah.
Oh, Robin, I'm so glad you got the help that you needed as well. And that was something that I know yesterday, Daniel Miles, at one point I went, okay, I've got to actually turn the television off.
Yeah, you have to make that call and really just remove yourself in some ways, don't you? Because it's so easy, and we've learned that from constant tragedies, that it's so easy to get sucked in. And, I mean, Tim from St Kilda's texted us saying, as a person who's lived with complex PTSD for many years due to trauma, I find the reporting of Saturday's murders quite shocking and very triggering. Just stop talking about it so much and move on. You won't be thinking or feeling about it in a few days' time. And I guess that's one of the other things that, as we heard from Michael, one of the approaches is avoidance. If you see those triggers in yourself, they are things worth keeping an eye on. And of course, we've mentioned there's numbers that you can call if this has been triggering or is alarming for you. Lifeline's always available on 13 11 14 and Kids Helpline as well, 1-800-551-800.
On the
ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Good morning, Rochelle Hunt and Daniel Miles with you. We're looking at what helps and what works when it comes to experiencing a traumatic event. What research is telling us from everything from recognising PTSD to the right language and techniques to use to support someone, not just in the days after, but possibly the years after experiencing a traumatic event. There's a text here from a social worker, Dan, and it says, I recently had a friend put the language of being triggered down to being, in inverted commas, woke. That approach shows a lack to being trauma-informed. Triggers are real, and when we know that they're there, that we can find it easier to manage and to work with them. That's from Katie, who's in Clunes, who's also a social worker. I mean, even just the idea of giving trigger warnings is something that we've seen in our lifetime, something that previously never existed. There is some debate around whether trigger warnings actually help or hinder when it comes to
those that are triggered.
Those that are triggered, exactly.
But I mean, one of the touch points that we keep coming back to is 9/11, because that is an event that changed the world, it changed our lives. And I think there's an element of us being a lot more informed about trauma since, in the decades that we've had since. Someone who knows a little bit more about it than you and I is Tony Fitzgerald, who's the Virtual Services Manager at Kids Helpline and Yourtown. Tony, we've been talking throughout this discussion about the impact that tragedies like this can have on kids. Can you tell us, is this something that the helpline's done any research into, that you're particularly aware of, the way that children might respond to tragedies like we've seen in Bondi?
Yeah, good morning, Rochelle and Daniel. Thank you for having me this morning. And it's a really good question. We do see this over and over again when there are significant events like we've seen on Saturday. I think there are two sides to it. We've had calls over the weekend, particularly yesterday, from children, young people who have recognised that they're not feeling great about what they've seen and they need to speak to someone. And even parents have called us up as well, which is terrific. But I think there's also what we've seen in the past, kids who have been exposed to this and have not been able to vocalise or verbalise what's going on for them. And I think that's really important, particularly for parents to keep an eye out for at the moment, particularly if they've got, say, teenage kids who are jumping on social media and being exposed over and over to the content that's there at the moment. Obviously, your discussions this morning have been around how that can be very traumatising. And sometimes kids can internalise that and really not vocalise what's going on. And that's where parents need to really keep a close eye on their kids at the moment.
How do you find that balance, Tony, between not hiding a child from the realities of life and what can occur, but then at the same time not freaking them out? How do you strike that balance, and how much does it depend on the child and how well you are as a communicator, as a parent, as a carer?
Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head. It is finding that balance. I think for starters, we shouldn't shy away from the fact that something's happened, and that's an opportunity for us as parents to open up a conversation with our kids and let them know that, you know, it's okay to feel upset or worried or concerned about this. It's a perfectly normal human reaction. So normalising that initially and going, yes, this terrible, terrible thing has happened, and it's really sad. It's very terrible. And it's okay to feel bad about it. But then also, you know, ensuring that we're not overexposing our kids and, let's be frank, ourselves to what we're seeing. And you know, the conversation previously around the balance between media and social media, I think we've got to be really careful about social media because there aren't those trigger warnings.
Well, that's right. And the images, it was incredible. I was glued to the television as it was unfolding and flicking around. And I have to say, every network did a fairly incredible job because it was unfolding at the time. And our own ABC TV anchor gave a really frank warning. He said, look, there are a lot of horrific images going and doing the rounds on social media at the moment, unfiltered images. Be careful. Yeah. Be careful what you click on. don't look at them, look after yourself. And then he gave all of the numbers, like Kids Helpline, like Lifeline, and it just felt like such a responsible warning to just, because the thing is, they are uncensored, and before you know it, you've clicked on something that you can never unsee.
That's exactly right. Yeah, and that's the challenge with social media is that it's everywhere. It's ubiquitous. It's on multiple platforms, and you know, particularly our teenage kids whose lives revolve around social media. Let's be frank about that. That's their life. You know, it's so easy for them to fall into that rabbit hole of just continuing to absorb and consume some really, really distressing content. So, you know, and I think the other aspect of it is we need to make sure that our social media companies are taking some responsibility here as well. Mm. I know the Office of the Safety Commission has put out some guidance this morning. If we remember back to those really horrific events in Christchurch a few years ago, that actually, you know, triggered some changes to the way this content can be, you know, the safety commission has actually got powers to ask social media companies to take down content. And this fits into a similar category, I think. You know, there's got to be some responsibility on these companies to make sure that they're not, you know, they're taking some steps like the traditional media do to warn people, and particularly young people, around how distressing this content can be.
Absolutely. We're speaking with Tony Fitzgerald, the Virtual Services Manager at Kids Helpline and Your Town. Tony, in matters like this, do you generally see a spike in both the amount of calls that you're receiving from kids, but also the breadth of ages of children that are calling up?
We certainly, you know, it's only been a couple of days, but when I had a look this morning, we've certainly had an increase in calls over the weekend, and we've had some contact from children and young people, and as I said before, parents who are seeking some support, which is great. We really want to continue to encourage that. It's interesting. We'll probably see a continuation of these calls for many weeks and months, really, and at some point in time there'll be young people reaching out to us who are not feeling great and can't associate what has happened to their feelings. And that's where it gets a little bit trickier for us to try and unpack that. But we've got a team of professional counsellors here who are here 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and are able to talk and guide our young people through how they might be feeling. And it's no different to other events. We do see an increase in calls. We do see young people reaching out for help, and we really want to continue to encourage that, particularly in the wake of this event.
Which is incredible, isn't it? I mean, that's the win, that we know that people are reaching out for help and that they are making those calls. Unfortunately, it's because of awful and traumatic things that are happening, but the idea of just recognising it and knowing that there are people to call, we always say that there is someone there ready to take your call 24 hours a day, whether it be Lifeline or whether it be Kids Helpline. Tony Fitzgerald, a huge thank you to you and to your entire team for the work that you do.
Thanks, Rochelle. Thanks, Daniel. And take care, everyone.
Yeah, take care. Tony Fitzgerald, Virtual Services Manager at Kids Helpline and Your Town. Pop this number in your phone. It's Kids Helpline. It's 1-800-55-1800. As Tony said, there is someone there 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. The other number to stick in your phone is Lifeline. That is 13 11 14. That number is for you. Don't think that it's for someone else. That number is there for you to be able to use it anytime you want. Here on The Conversation Hour, my name's Rochelle Hunt, your co-host this morning, Daniel Miles. We're looking at what works and what helps and what the research is telling us when we recognise PTSD and what the right language and techniques are to use to support someone in the days and years after experiencing a traumatic event. Rochelle Hunt and Daniel Miles with you as we look at trauma, how it manifests in our minds and our bodies, and what the right thing to do is. How can we help? There's a text here from Margie, and it says, I was a year advisor to a year 9 class in regional New South Wales at the time of 9/11. Every week in guidance for 3 to 4 weeks, the kids wanted to talk about being reassured that everything would be fine. It was a shocking thing for them because it was real and it wasn't a movie. So how do you digest it, and how do we help, and what is the research telling us around what potentially the right thing to do is. Dr. Kate Brady is a technical advisor with the Australian Red Cross, and she's also a senior research fellow with the University of Melbourne. And you may know her as the host of ABC's podcast After the Disaster. Dr. Brady, a warm welcome back to the Conversation Hour. Some incredible research is being done by international bodies, including yourself at the Red Cross, on early intervention. It's called psychological first aid. What does that mean?
Yeah, psychological first aid is a really helpful tool that we all have in our toolkit because it's about having a really humanistic response to awful things. And one of the best things about psychological first aid is it's a bit like physical first aid. Anyone can do it. You don't have to be a doctor. You don't have to be a psychiatrist or a psychologist. It's really around helping people establish a few things. So one of those is helping them reestablish a sense of safety. One is about helping people reestablish a sense of calm, of connection, of what we call self-efficacy, so this belief that you can do things that make a difference in your life. And these are really, really important things for people to be able to sort of remember, because when we have these really big events, really big disruptions, it can be easy for us to forget them. One of the really important things to remember about people who are exposed to trauma, and most of us will be exposed to some sort of trauma in our life, is most people recover really well with a bit of help from friends, family, colleagues, and also techniques like psychological first aid, which is just really around connecting as humans and helping people remember what they've got to sort of hold on to.
Kate, how much has the way that we deal with trauma and approach traumatic events like this changed over the decades? It feels like we've got a better understanding on what triggers are, for example, and how to best approach that in a way that's safe for everyone. But how has the way that we approach and treat trauma changed?
Yeah, it's a really great question. I think for a long time we didn't know a lot about it. So traumatic events and really big disruptive events have been going on for all of human history, and different cultures manage this and cope with this differently. But if we're thinking about Western perspectives, it's really changed sort of over the last 100 years. If we think about, for example, war veterans returning and people really not understanding the impact on them and things like that. So we can see that that's changed. But one of the things that things like psychological first aid help us remember is we don't need to pathologize everything. So most people do recover really well from big shocks. And so we don't need to think about this as everyone needing a medical intervention or everyone needing to see a psychiatrist. Most people, if they have good people around them, people that make them feel good, people that they can connect to, things that they can do that they enjoy, most people recover really well. And then there's additional support if that's not working for you. And you can do things like, as you guys have been talking about, calling places like Lifeline or Headspace or the Kids Helpline. But also just having a chat with your GP. GPs are trained to help people figure out what kind of help they need after this.
I wonder how much of that we can do for ourselves. There's a bang on text here from Sue. And Sue, I couldn't agree with you more. Mine's a different image. But Sue says here, sometimes it's the extra detail that triggers the trauma. For example, hearing about the woman handing her baby to strangers and imagining the fear and the utter catastrophic moment that was potentially for her keeps playing in a loop in my head as a mum. Yeah. It triggers deep emotional trauma in me. And even reading that out, it's almost impossible to read out because that image plays over in my mind, the image of the dad putting the face masks over his daughter's eyes so they couldn't witness what was happening. For whatever reason, we all react differently. How do we stop that loop? And how traumatic and how much of an impact is it having on us if we can't stop that loop in our brain?
Yeah, so it's really important to remember that these type of awful events feel very overwhelming because they're shocking. Like they're the definition of shocking. And because of that, what they do is they rattle that foundational underpinning that we've got of how the world works or how the world should work. So having these big unsettled reactions are very normal reactions to very abnormal events. It's not common. These events aren't common. They're very rare, and that's why they feel so shocking to us. And so those ripples from things like sometimes these type of events are referred to as collective trauma events. And the ripples from these events are really far-reaching. And part of that is because the media coverage now is so readily available and so intense. But it's also because we often identify with the victims and we can put ourselves there. You know, I take my kids to a shopping centre all the time. My daughter works in that place. You know, I was there last week. And so we have these really visceral connections where we put ourselves in the place of the victim. Now, replaying things like those really awful additional details as you're talking about, that is a normal part of processing it. So these are normal reactions to abnormal events. What you want to be thinking about is if this is still an invasive thought for you in a couple of weeks' time, or if it's stopping you from being fearful about doing things that you normally do, or if you're not able to sleep, or you're having really big mood changes, that's when you want to go and have a chat to a GP. But we also can't beat ourselves up about hearing something very shocking or seeing something very, very unsettling and then having a reaction to it. That's what being human is. That's our brains trying to adjust and cope to the information that's in there. So we don't need to sort of beat ourselves up for
playing things on loop or whatever it is.
Or why am I thinking about this? You're thinking about it because it's deeply meaningful to you. You've made a connection to it for something that's really shocking. So the things that we know help us reestablish sort of those more settled routines are things like being around people that we know make us feel good, even if we're not really feeling like being social creatures at the moment. It's really important we make those connections with people that make us feel good. Go and have a meal with someone, go and take a walk with someone, hang out with someone, watching a movie that is a light, dumb, fluffy thing, you know, like hang out with people that make you feel good, go and play sport, whatever it is that makes you feel good. And the other thing is having routines. So it can seem really silly to say, no, you just need to have a routine in your day. But these are the things that help us feel back in control of our life when we've been made to feel like things are out of our control. So having routines, I get up at this time, I have my breakfast, maybe I talk to my family, I make my bed, I get dressed, I go to work. Those routines are the things that we can control at a time that we feel out of control. So they're really important too. Mm.
And there are so many numbers that you can call at any time. 1-3-11-14 is Lifeline, and of course Kids Helpline 1-800-55-1800. Dr. Kate Brady, before we let you go, we're talking about this now because we are living in the epicenter of the shocks of this truly traumatic event. But this is something that can bop its head up in weeks, months, years. Yeah. How do you approach the trauma and the triggers that last well beyond when this is out of the media cycle, for example?
Yeah, so again, it's around connecting with the people around you in the first instance. So be kind to people around you, ask people how they're doing. And if you feel like someone around you is having a really disproportionate reaction to what you think they should be, it can be really easy to judge them or to say, well, you weren't even there, or you don't even know the people. You don't do that. You don't need to judge people. It might be bringing stuff up for them from other events or from other things that have happened in their lives. So again, trying to be around people who make us feel good, doing things that we know make us feel good, having these good routines, and then asking for help if we need it. We know these things take a long time for some people, and there'll be different things that come up, you know, over time, whether it's coronial inquesting findings that come up in a couple of months' time, or whether it's media coverage around the anniversary event, things like that. These are things that will pop up and they'll rattle us again. So being able to have those supports around us and asking for help if we need is really important. But be kind to people about their reaction.
Dr. Kate Brady, thanks so much for your time and your expertise.
Thanks for having me.
Technical advisor for the Australian Red Cross and research fellow for the University of Melbourne. And they've got incredible research resources, the Australian Red Cross. You can go to their website. And looking through and even reading through what psychological first aid is really helpful, not just for you as an individual, but maybe, you know, if you run a small business or you're a school teacher or whatever it may be, going through and looking at their psychological first aid. I just want to go through some of the texts, Daniel, that have come in, because this is not just about what happened at Bondi. This it can be
Any trauma.
That's right. So this, it says, often forgotten is the effect that trauma will have on our first responders. After 10 years of police service, my son was diagnosed with CPTSD. His marriage broke up and he lost contact with me for 2 years. And this is coming from Sharon in Ballarat. And I think everybody was thinking about the community of Ballarat over the weekend. It says, coming from Ballarat, where recently 3 women have been murdered in 61 days, this event is compounding our collective trauma. And that's something we haven't even looked at, is the understanding and the research that now goes into collective trauma. But I want to read out a quite a long text, and I won't give her name. And again, we've been giving trigger warnings, so this is a fairly alarming text. So I just want to give a little warning before I read it. I survived being stabbed some years ago when a man armed with a large knife roamed around my local area on a sunny afternoon. He was targeting women in particular. I was tremendously lucky to survive his attack. Many people rushed to help, and I'll never forget the young man, a trainee nurse, who attended to me while we waited for the ambos and the police. He put aside his own terror while he showered me with his care and skill. Another man brought me a blanket. Perhaps these kind men responding in the early moments after this misogynist attack have helped me process what happened, along with the tender words of the male judge who was presiding over my case. My heart goes out to everyone suffering from this latest trauma in Sydney. And my heart is pounding out of my chest, Daniel, reading that text. I mean, there are extreme cases like that from this woman who sent through that message. So thank you, because even writing that out must have been traumatic for you to send it. But it's how others respond that can help us get through that traumatic event. Like Kate Brady said, don't judge. Don't judge someone's trauma. Don't judge someone's reaction to something.
You never know what's been in their past or what they've witnessed or gone through themselves. So absolutely thank you for the strength putting that through and sending it to us, because it not only resonates with you and your family so personally, but it really does hit a chord with all of us. Deb's given us a call in Warrandyte. Deb, good morning.
Yeah, hi. It's just about a sort of cumulative trauma response. Like, we were very close to being slammed by the 2009 fires, and we lost two friends. And all night, I remember listening to ABC Radio as people were helping each other out, you know, getting out of Tulangi and all of that. And then a couple of years later, I was in New Zealand talking to the earthquake people who'd fled Christchurch, and I had a very visceral, teary response listening to them. It was like a shared thing. And there's been a couple of events since then where I respond with tears, like I cry. And the same happened when I heard this thing with Bondi Junction. And I think that's just a way of releasing. It's normal. And so I regard it as a normal visceral response. I don't think I'm holding on to stuff. I just think we generally just respond like that. But particularly when we hear acts of kindness from people, it's just a very normal emotional response.
And how much better do we feel after a cry, Deb?
Every time, and you know, sometimes, I mean, I can't look at any of the Palestinian stuff because it's too overwhelming. But it's I think we all have this collective response to violence or trauma. And I think if we all know that we're all in the same boat, all feeling the same stuff, and it's a very human response, then it's such a reflection of how the world really is, and not, and not what the violent.
Acts or individuals. Deb, thank you for giving us a call and sharing your experience, because it is something that resonates beyond those involved widely to a community, to a state, to a nation, and as you mentioned, quite globally. Milad Haghani is a senior lecturer of urban mobility, public safety and disaster risk at the University of New South Wales in Sydney, and this is something that Milad's been looking at for quite some time. Good morning. Thank you for joining us on what is a very tricky conversation to have. How do we learn from experiences like this, Milad?
Good morning, Daniel and Rochelle, and thank you for having me this morning. And before I start, may I just say that my heart goes out to all the people who have been affected by this tragedy, and especially to the families of the ones who have been lost and injured. Well, in my studies, I have been looking into the acts of violence or acute cases of emergencies and mass casualties in crowded spaces. And while they are rare, they do happen, unfortunately. We have seen them happening in shopping centers, in concert venues, in sporting events and public transport areas. What we have learned from this particular incident in Sydney is a reminder of the actions that bystanders can take in order to mitigate the effect of such an incident. Traditionally, when we talk about bystanders, we are talking about people who are involved in the scene and they are facing the same level of dangers. But in this case, we have seen that people are not just passive bystanders, and rather they take actions that can minimize harm to people. That is why I am calling them essentially zero responders, because it's time for us to see their role as part of the emergency response team. And why do I make that assertion? The reason is that in any case of mass casualty event or public emergency, such as this one, there is always a time gap between the occurrence of the incident and when the first responders are taking control of the situation. And those first few minutes are really, really crucial in maximizing survival and mitigating the effect. And what we have seen in this case is that people have shown how bystanders can make a crucial role, can play a crucial role in containing the situation. For example, the Samaritan who stopped the person, who stopped the attacker on the escalator, for example, or other people who intervened. They bought precious seconds, and we don't know how many lives were saved by the actions that they took. And also the people who administered first aid and tried to stop bleeding of the people. These are the actions that can really make a difference in terms of mitigating an effect of a public emergency like this.
And I guess when we're talking about sort of how familiar these spaces are, you know, whether it be a shopping centre or an aeroplane or the MCG, we know the MCG was discussed a lot some years ago when our terror warning threat was sort of medium or high. And I know, Dan, you and I were talking about how there was periods where we actually quite proactively looked out and sort of worked out where the exits were or where would I hide if I needed to. We start to think differently. But what I find fascinating, Millard, is that many of us put ourselves into that situation of Bondi, and I guess we would think, well, how would I react? How do I know how I would react at that time? Is there something about those familiar spaces that you look into with your research, with your experiments that do simulate life-threatening scenarios and how crowds do and don't respond?
Absolutely, absolutely. Mental preparedness can make a big difference. If you are vigilant in a crowded space, my research has shown that you take better actions and that increases chance of survival, for example. In terms of the actions that people can take, not everybody is in the position of helping. Not everybody is close enough to the source of danger to help. But being a zero responder does not necessarily mean that. You can increase the chance of survival by making good evacuation decisions and taking yourself and your family outside the place of danger as quickly as possible, and also encouraging other people to do that as well. So as part of my research, I simulate the cases of acute emergencies in crowded places with actual crowds of people.
Oh,
I try to simulate these situations akin to the situations that we have seen in this shopping center. And we have seen that by altering certain aspects of people's behavior, for example, the collective efficiency of the process can be significantly improved. Some of these areas are, for example, in how quickly people respond to a threat. For example, there is this misconception that when we hear a loud bang, a source of danger, we always tend to, some people do, some people tend to take their time and evaluate the situation. And when you ask them why you do that, their reasoning is that I do not want to look panicked in case this is a false alarm. The cost of reacting to a false alarm is quite negligible comparing to the alternative of underreacting to an actual threat. And also some people tend to walk away from danger as opposed to running, because they encourage people to walk in the case of an emergency and not run. Whereas I have experimented these things in laboratory conditions, and I have seen that when people take quick, swift, and decisive actions and show agility in their decision-making, the collective process is much, much more efficient.
Wow. I mean, these experiments and this research seems more important now than ever before. Millard, thank you so much for your time. Millard Hagani is a Senior Lecturer of Urban Mobility, Public Safety and Disaster Risk at the University of New South Wales. And it's interesting when events like this happen, Dan, I think we all are on high alert, and when we walk back into that shopping centre next, or Bourke Street or the MCG or whatever it may be, we sort of do evaluate things differently. But then I have this I have this internal reaction with myself to be like, I hate that I'm thinking like this, but at the same time, I want to be vigilant and I want to know where I need to go. But you sort of have this internal struggle with yourself over it.
That's the thing. You almost hate yourself for having to think that in a way. I hate that I have to be conscious of this. But, you know, as Milad Haghani just pointed out for us so brilliantly, there's a collective mindset that actually has benefits when we all do have that in our mind. And I guess that's where we're living at the moment, isn't it?
There's a text here from Maggie, who's in Mordialloc, and she says, I had a chat with my 10-year-old about how there was one bad person in the Bondi incident, but many people who were doing the right thing. We talked about the different responses from heroes who actively got involved to people who helped the injured and other people, and how brave the policewoman was in protecting everyone. I think it gave him some perspective on what we were seeing. Thank you, Maggie. If we didn't get a chance to read out your text today, then apologies. Don't forget the numbers Lifeline 13 11 14, Kids Helpline 1-800-55-1800. And if you want to look more into psychological first aid and what that means and how you can use it, then go to the Red Cross's website. And that's what Dr. Kate Brady was talking about. As always, Daniel Miles joining us from ABC Warrnambool. Thank you, mate.
Thanks, Rish.
I'll be back with you tomorrow. Until then, take care and we'll speak soon.